The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, welcome to another edition of the Russian Orthodox Medievalist. Today, we're going to be dealing with an issue of tremendous importance for those people who are interested in the political theory and ideas of ethnic nationalism. And what we're going to deal with is really the collapse of Ukrainian independence under the pressure of the Bolshevik invasion at the end of World War I. And we're going to start in the 1870s. You know, Ukraine, we have a situation where we have a Ukrainian state, we have people who accept the idea of a Ukrainian, an Orthodox identity, without much of a chance of actually building an independent Ukrainian state. This is a substantial object lesson for those of us who are concerned with questions of multipolarity, with the questions of nationalism and true ethnic sovereignty in an age of globalization, of forced globalization. So, there are a few points to be made, first of all. In the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s in Ukraine, there is an increasing impoverishment of the Ukrainian peasantry. There is a certain degree of land hunger. There is substantial population growth. But at the same time, there is also...
The Voice of Reason Radio.
The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist, where we deal almost exclusively with issues concerning old Russia, Ukraine, and to some extent the Middle Ages, both in the East and the West. There was a time where this show was called The Orthodox Medievalist, and my website, my web journal, is called that. And what I want to say is that medievalism and nationalism are not mutually opposed ideas, as is often stated, partially because the national idea is manifest in places like Ukraine and Poland, does not concern the state. The state might be nice as a means of protecting the ethnic group and the religion, but it is not necessary. And that ethnic groups have existed long before the modern state came into existence. And the nation, therefore, is the ethnic group defined to a large extent by religion and language and customs, ways of life, this sort of thing. The state usually does more harm than good relative to these nations. So there is a nationalism of the Middle Ages, although it generally didn't involve the state. Although there are exceptions to that, like in places like Ukraine and Poland, and even in Scandinavia, Ireland and Scotland, these are all exceptions to that rule. But on the continent in general, you didn't have this immediate connection between nation and state like you have in the 19th century. But I do want to say that the nation concerns the religion, the ethnicity, the language, and the customs of a people. The state may or may not be added later on as this protective outer coating. It's a protective outer coating, but, you know, the real problem is that oftentimes the state legitimizes itself through the nation. The state attempts to standardize the nation. The state tries to live off the nation and eventually does more harm than good. So I want to make that very clear. Today we're going to talk about Poland. I've wanted to talk about Poland for a long time, but other things have come up. Poland, of course, is something extremely important to Ukrainian history, something in which I specialize and focus on. But Poland is also a puzzle. Poland is very much a puzzle because you have a group of people. Let me set out the problematic here. The problematic is that Poland starts out as a group of Western Slavs squished between Orthodox Russia on one side and the German kingdoms on the other. Now, you would think with this very inauspicious way to begin a national life, they would have developed centralized national institutions. They never do. And it's this lack of a central authority figure that is ultimately the cause of the fall of Polish statehood at the end of the 18th century, where Poland will be divided among Austria, Russia, and Prussia. It seems common sense that when a country comes into its own ethnic and religious existence, like Poland does, squished between these two major powers, and even worse, having more or less autonomous groups like the Teutonic Knights and the Livonian Knights to fight in order to create their national existence. So you have, you know, simply speaking, you have Poland coming into existence among three major powers. And yet, given all of that, still not developing centralized institutions. That's the real issue here, and it's something that stymies political science. You know, because political science will tell you that when a country develops in such a way, it will develop centralized royal and military institutions in order to consolidate the power of the state. You see it in Russia, you see it everywhere. Poland is one of these exceptions. And it's kind of a weird anomaly, I think, and that's going to be the subject of our talk today. My information comes from a whole bunch of sources, but something I've come across recently is a work called The Fall of Poland. It's about 1,800 pages in two volumes by L.C. Saxon. It came out in 1852. And the thesis of the book is that the Polish nobility are the cause of the destruction of Poland and of the fact that it could not and would not develop centralized institutions, no matter how many enemies, centralized, militarized enemies that surrounded the Polish Commonwealth throughout its existence. Now, I want to stress here that Poland at one time was a very large, very powerful empire stretching from the Baltics to practically the Black Sea. So I don't want to, you know, I don't want to suggest that noble rule in any way meant anything other than nation building. But the nation and the empire that it created, that galls Ukrainian nationalists to this day, it could not last. And in fact, was so riddled with problems that in reality, it was a paper tiger. And that's going to be our topic for today. We're going to talk about those variables and those objects in Polish life that caused its downfall and its object lesson for any of us who are interested in nation building and what a nation truly is really never ends. Poland is really a major, significant power in Central Europe and deserves far more attention than it's normally given. And although Poland has really throughout its entire existence been the enemy of everything Orthodox, everything connected to the Orthodox faith, I want to make it very clear that the Polish people never had any rights as individuals until until very recently. Really until the post-World War I era. So I want to say that the Polish nobility is the cause of Poland's decline, Poland's destruction as a state. But the Polish nobility were slave owners, and slave owners straight up into the era of Catherine the Great in Russia, where Poland was then partitioned among the three powers that I mentioned before. What we're going to talk about today really is this mighty power that really was a house of cards. And the Polish nobility, the aristocracy, was the reason why the Polish Empire was as permeable and really as weak as it really was. And I want to talk about the thesis of L.C. Saxton, which to a great extent dovetails with my own work on the Polish question. And the first fact that will make sense out of this idea is that only members of the aristocracy could own land. No other person, not the middle classes, not the Jews, and I'll say this again, but 80% of the Jewish population of the world at the beginning of the 17th century lived in the Polish Empire. So the Jews are a huge player here. But they, legally speaking, although there were ways to evade this, they could not own land. Only members of the old Polish nobility could own land, which means that land prices generally were suppressed, were kept low. But this is a product. This is a product of the oligarchic constitution of Poland, where only members of the aristocracy were actually citizens, only members of the aristocracy speaking Latin, not Polish or Ukrainian or anything else, had any political rights whatsoever, and political rights very easily translated into economic rights and vice versa. I want to say that Saxton's thesis generally is that it was noble arrogance that destroyed Poland and that prevented her from developing centralized military institutions like all of her neighbors were doing. And as a result of that, she eventually was divided up among those powers capable of doing so. But part of the way that this was done was by the suppression of the urban populations, the so-called middle classes, the professions, the merchants, and they were banned from owning land. That element that switched in Western Europe the middle part of the Middle Ages to the High Middle Ages, the middle classes in the towns, the people who were actually making liquid money, who altered the nature of political opinion in the West, for better or for worse, that was not permitted to develop in Poland. Merchants and the professions living in the towns were forbidden to own land, and their world, their economic world, was controlled by the nobility. The nobility will do everything in their power. And I want to say that, say, by 1600, the titled nobility in Poland maybe averaged about 450,000 people. They destroyed any competition from the monarchy and the church on the one side and the popular masses as well as the urban population on the other. Of all the states in Europe in the Middle Ages, Renaissance, and the modern period, the Polish version of serfdom was the most severe. And Saxton will go so far as to say that serfdom did not exist in Poland, only slavery existed in Poland. serfdom and feudalism assume that nobles have responsibilities to those above them. And yet in Poland, there was nobody above the nobility. So the country, essentially, was a series of noble estates worked by slaves. The nobles would come together. The first noble assembly or diet took place in 1331. They would come together and work out their own individual problems. That was Polish politics for a long period of time. And that serfdom in Poland was far worse than serfdom in Russia or Germany or Gaul or any other place. Monarchs in general were powerless to deal with noble power. There were attempts, like you see in France and elsewhere, that a monarch will attempt to use the lower nobility to fight the upper nobility in order to divide them and therefore enhance royal power. These never quite worked. And I want to suggest, I'm not being dogmatic here, but I want to suggest to you that the reason that this occurred is largely because there was no middle class. There was no merchant class of native Polish stock in the cities that a king could go to. You had this in England quite often, where a monarch can go to London or Kent or, you know, someplace like this and promise the merchant class level of power in exchange for money. This never occurred in Poland because the nobility controlled what little merchant activity there was. And whatever kind of reform effort came, that existed throughout Europe, that developed. Remember, Poland was the easternmost boundary of the Enlightenment and the Renaissance before that, and that kind of leaked into Ukraine, and as a result, ended up leaking into Russia. So Poland was a very, very important and sophisticated conduit of Western European culture into the Slavic world. And this is one of the reasons that Ukraine is very Western-oriented in its approach to politics, liturgy, religion, and everything else, without ever altering their Orthodox faith and centeredness. And it's one of these things that makes Ukrainian Orthodoxy different from Russian or Greek Orthodoxy. And really, the conduit to that was the fact that much of Ukraine was under Polish rule for a very long period of time. But any kind of reform effort to reorganize the state, to reorganize the constitution, was destroyed at its inception by the nobility. There was never any sense, even, of representative government among the nobility. In fact, representative government was destroyed by the nobility. But I want to suggest, here's the central issue. No member of the aristocracy could engage in commerce of any kind whatsoever without falling into tremendous disgrace by and through his peers. Now, the Polish nobility were smart enough not to give over the necessary economic power, the merchant power, liquid banking power, to Poles. So what did they do? This is the thesis here. This is the central concept. They gave it to the Jews. Like I said, about 80% of the world's Jews will eventually move to the Polish Empire, even to the point where Jews prior to the Cossack revolt of Khmelnytsky will view the Polish Empire as the new Jerusalem, and even more than that, the Jews will view the Polish Empire as in and of itself messianic. And that the Messiah will come because the Jews have been given a tremendous level of power in the Polish Empire. Not until 21st century America will the Jews ever gain this level of power. The Jews controlled all of the money in Poland. They controlled all the commerce of Poland. They controlled the monarchy and they controlled the nobility, and they did this through the fact that the only people who had any access to liquid money mobile, fungible liquid money were the Jews that were deliberately imported from Khazaria, from southern Russia, into the Polish Empire. And the and the nobles did this to, number one, keep the monarchy away from money, keep actual Poles away from money, and keep any of their political opponents away from money. So by the middle of the 16th century, beginning of the 17th century, the nadir of the Polish Empire, you had a powerless monarchy, you had a completely noble-dominated society, you had millions of slaves of Polish Catholic nationality, and the towns like Krakow and elsewhere were populated by Jews who were given licenses by the nobility to engage in all banking, all trade, and the nobility collectively gave the Jewish population in Poland an absolute monopoly over the sale and distilling of alcohol. I want to suggest to you guys that a huge proportion of the modern Jewish mentality came into existence due to their immensely favorable treatment in the Polish Empire at the beginning of the 17th century. So what does this all mean? As the Ukrainian Orthodox used to say in the 17th century, Poland was an aristocratic Judaic republic. All commerce, all liquid money was given over to the Jews by the Polish nobility collectively with the idea of keeping the nobles out of the merchant world and the banking world and keeping the peasants from getting wealthy by engaging in anything that concerned actual money, trade, and commerce. And then, both as a cause and as a result of all of this, the Polish nobility scorned anything having to do with commerce and gain. And like you had in Western Europe and Russia and a lot of other places, the nobility had no sense of budgeting, no sense of controlling spending, and as a result went deeply into debt. How were these debts financed? They were financed by going to Krakow, going to the major cities, Gdansk and elsewhere, and taking money from the Jews. Taking money from the Jews in terms of taxes as well as loans, and not just the nobility, but also the monarchy, such as it was. And as a result, the Jews not only took all economic power, you know, by 1700 the Jews were entirely in control of the money, but they were entirely in control of the monarchy. So what you had was a largely parasitic nobility, with the exception of those nobles that had manifest military talent. And it were those nobles, including those who became monarchs like Sobieski, who had tremendous military talent, who built and maintained the Polish Empire with Jewish liquidity, with Jewish money. Now, as a result of all of this, the nobles passed in the Polish Diet, and remember the capital was Krakow in the Renaissance, many privileges to themselves were passed within the Diet. No noble could be arrested until after the noble was convicted. Saxton's idea is that there really was no such thing as law or politics in Polish society, and that any real dispute was solved with violence, duels, or even military factionalization within the nobility. And I want to make it clear, and Saxton and pretty much everyone else who writes on Polish history makes it very clear, that the Polish army was not a centralized national army for the most part. The nobles raised their own troops from their own estates, and they borrowed Jewish money to buy mercenaries from Germany or anywhere else. Needless to say, no noble ever paid taxes. This is one of the things that was central to the noble idea. No serf. And I don't want to use the word serf here. Saxton and so many others use the word slave. serfs did not have the rights that existed in Russia or even in Western Europe in the Middle Ages. And this goes straight up to the abolition of the Polish kingdom at the end of the 18th century. Polish serfs were slaves without rights, and they rights or any privileges of any kind. That was not the case in Russia. That was not the case in Western Europe. That was only the case in Poland. And no serf can own weapons. Again, that was not the case in Russia either. Serfs could own weapons in Russia, as was proven by the Bolotnikov and Razin rebellions. But in Poland, no serf or slave could own weapons, and no serf or slave could learn the military arts. Now, one of the things that the Polish nobility did to enhance the power of Jews is to say that the Jews could not own land. All of their wealth had to exist in liquid form. Polish agriculture was always very weak because a slave economy is never an efficient economy. Most, in fact, and Saxton holds this, a number of other scholars do as well, most Polish land was not, in fact, cultivated. Poland was involved in exporting food only sporadically. For the most part, Jewish liquidity was borrowed for the sake of importing food from Russia and elsewhere. This is why it became very important for the Poles to take right bank Ukraine, because there you had a level of fertility that did not exist in Poland, and a great yield could be produced with actual little effort.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com.
There's a lot of attention today on the catastrophic oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. While there's much to talk about there, a bigger story is leaking: the war in Afghanistan. What began as a special forces operation in 2001, now a full-on war. So is there hope, or is it a lost cause? Just last week, General Stanley McChrystal summed up the basic problem facing NATO forces in Kandahar. In a NATO meeting, he said, quote, "When you go to protect people, the people have to want you to protect them." Sounding the alarm of uncertainty, McChrystal's skepticism has made its way to Capitol Hill. Today at a congressional hearing, some of America's top military minds, including General David Petraeus, attempted to ease concerns that the war in Afghanistan is not lost. Some on the committee even blamed poor media reporting for the decrease in support of the war. RT correspondent Jihan Hafiz has the latest on war concerns and contradictions.
Was it dehydration or a bad omen? The sight of the U.S. military's top commander collapsing just before an emergency congressional hearing appears to reflect the gridlock that has become the war in Afghanistan.
It's an unusual way to open a hearing, condemning what nearly half a dozen members on this committee called trash journalism, which they insist is skewing public opinion and the president's judgment on how the military is performing in Afghanistan, now the country's longest war in U.S. history.
According to what is probably trash journalism,
notwithstanding anything that we may have read and what my dear friend and colleague from Arizona has described as trash journalism.
Can you tell me a bit about what trash journalism is as far as covering Afghanistan?
I don't know what they're referring to, frankly. There has been a series of negative reports.
Trash journalism, I think, would be exaggerating successes or minimizing failures and putting our soldiers in a bad light.
But trash journalism didn't trigger or even cause multiple battalions of the Afghan National Army from failing their highly anticipated validity tests. Nor did it scale back what was supposed to be a major offensive in Kandahar, or guarantee success in the military's latest full-scale operation into Taliban stronghold Marja.
Conversations with President Karzai.
Words of encouragement from sitcom commander General David Petraeus still didn't satisfy Vietnam War veteran Senator Jim Webb.
Are in the lead in problem?
I've never been optimistic. I've been hopeful. I have respect for the people who are doing this, but the questions that I asked a year ago really, I think, are the same.
This is June 2010. Are we winning?
Winning to a counterinsurgent center means making progress.
The congressional hearings came barely a day after General Petraeus pleaded with British allies for additional help and extended support. Also in the works, an emergency war supplemental topping $33 billion to aid the troop surge Obama pledged last year. Since that announcement 17 months ago, only 21,000 out of the 30,000 troops that are meant to be on the ground for the Kandahar invasion are still trickling in.
A slow process.
And what would you say the ultimate success in Afghanistan would be?
Well, I think it would be a stable government that allows the decent people of Afghanistan to be able to have a decent life.
A rosy picture Congress and the military heads are painting and trying to pursue in a country where bad news is more than just trash journalism. As for the July 2011 deadline for possible troop withdrawal,
that is not the date when we look for the door and try to turn off the light, but rather a date at which a process begins.
Jahan Hafiz, RT, Washington, D.C.
Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
The only things that really debased a noble in public in Poland was an interest in commerce. The Jews were given this privilege. Now, I want to say, of course, that the Jews did own land. They owned lots of it. But they couldn't own it in their own name, so they had to use some noble name to buy land. And they did this all the time. As I said before, all taverns were given over to Jewish control. And, a small portion was given over to the noble whose land the tavern was on, and the Jewish family and Kahal kept the remainder. And even, this attack on commerce from the nobles was so bad that they even refused, even throughout the age of Sobieski, to create and maintain good roads, because good roads meant exchange of ideas, exchange of goods, exchange of commerce. And the only time this was ever done is in the Jewish areas of Gdansk and Krakow. Both monarchs and nobles were forced, therefore, whenever they really were saturated and just oppressed by debt or needing to go on campaign against the knights, the Cossacks, or the Turks, needed to go to Jews for money. This is why, and I want to keep it clear, 1648, Bogdan Khmelnytsky, leading the Orthodox Ukrainian Cossacks, generally his target was the Jews. His target was the Jews because he realized that the entire Polish government was based on this constant ability of going to the Jews for liquid funds whenever they needed it. And for from the Jewish point of view, this was nothing. This was a legitimate business expense. They were given tremendous privileges, and the only thing they really needed to do is every once in a while forward money to the nobility or to the monarchy. There developed in Poland a Jesuit, Catholic, Jewish alliance against the Orthodox people of Eastern Poland, Ukrainian and Russian, as well, of course, as the Ukrainian Orthodox population represented militarily by the Cossacks. Whenever the Cossacks took military action against Poland, it was against the Jews. And the Jews suffered because Khmelnytsky and his successors realized that that's where the money, the government, and the armies came from. The nobles were generally useless. It was the Jews where the Polish nobility took their cash. And so if you want to know where the traditional Ukrainian antipathy to Jews comes from, this is the era. The Jews took over Poland and used their position to promote alcohol, to promote Catholicism, because it was in their interest to do so. Not because they care about Catholicism, but it's because it was in their interest to promote Catholicism and to suppress any trade other than their own. From the point of view of the Polish nobles, it was a brilliant move. Giving all the cash and trade to the Jews meant that trade became a Khazar linguistic Yiddish kind of in-group, and they were not going to share with anybody else. So you have this noble Jew movement, a coalition, so to speak, that fought the Ukrainian Cossacks on the one hand and certainly harmed the monarchy on the other hand, although it was not entirely unknown for the Polish monarch to go to the Jews for money. Noble land was never farmed properly. Slaves often refused to work. Slave revolts were fairly normal in Poland. And maybe 20% of noble land was ever cultivated at any given time. The estimates there differ, depending on who you read. Saxton has kind of an extreme view that maybe only 5 or 10% of the land was actually ever cultivated, because no one really cared. If worst came to worst, you go to the Jews, you get a few bucks, and you go and you buy food. You didn't need to grow it yourself. And so as a result, Poland becomes a country of merchant Jews and idle aristocrats. Something else, by the way, that the Polish aristocracy used were papal dispensations. In the 17th and 18th century, dispensations for various kinds of behavior, and especially relative to the Jews, were always for sale, not only by the papacy to the Polish nobility, but also the Polish nobility among themselves. So you can buy and trade papal dispensations to justify any behavior you can imagine. This is one of the reasons that the Protestant Reformation, which in no way do I support theologically, came into existence, because nowhere, even prior to Martin Luther in Germany, papal dispensations were almost a form of currency among the nobles of Poland. And, there was an attempt. I mean, I'm not saying that the monarchy, John Albert, for example, wanted to reform Poland on the British model, introducing the nobles and even some upper-level serfs to commerce, but it was killed in the Diet. Anything that altered noble Jewish domination of society was killed in the Diet, and these monarchs could be removed at will to a great extent. And Saxon holds to the view that there was no law in Poland. Law was whichever noble family dominated in a given area, it and its court proclaimed what the law was. And that Polish politics was, to a great extent, a constant physical battles among major Polish clans. In 1501, the noble diet promulgated absolutely that no monarch can have an income. And of course, you see this in Great Britain much later. No monarch can have an income unless it is approved by the noble diet. And that's debates in the Polish diet in Krakow, usually ended in violence, in duels. And the only reason, the only way that you would ever get unanimity among these people is by threat of massacre. And I want to say that the Russian principality of Novgorod in the Middle Ages has a lot in common with what later developed as the Polish Constitution. What developed later on was the so-called veto, where any member of the noble parliament could veto the decision of a majority. Therefore, you had to have 100% unanimity at any given time. But given that this is largely impossible, What it really meant was that the upper layer of the nobility could threaten everybody else to get what it wants. Like in the Russian Republic of Novgorod, what you ended up having were noble massacres where nobles were continually fighting one another. And the only way that legislation was ever passed really only was when one faction was able to buy enough mercenaries to threaten the remainder. And these noble decisions, of course, as I've already suggested, were largely in the hands of the Jews. Saxton holds to the view that the only real law, ultimately, is noble revenge. So one noble family would fight another. The dominant family would massacre the other. They would buy a papal dispensation, which would then be presented to the church in Poland, and they would then be sin-free. All of this, of course, was financed by loans from the Jews in Krakow and Gdansk and elsewhere. I want to suggest to you guys that Jewish power found its modern testing ground in Poland. And that the way that Jewish power functions in America or Great Britain or even in the Middle East was developed in the Polish Empire between the middle of the 15th century to the middle of the 18th century, where Poland was finally put out of its misery and divided among Austria, Prussia, and Russia. And yet the Polish-Jewish alliance in Ukraine, even under Habsburg Austria, continued to exist, and it was aimed always at the Orthodox Slavic population of Ukraine. Saxton also holds to the view that, of course, there was no real organized judiciary, and that everything concerned nobles, mercenaries, and how much money and at what level of interest you could raise this kind of liquidity from the Jews. Okay, how can we conclude all of this? We're talking about the existence of oligarchy. When the great Greek city of Constantinople fell to the Turks in 1453, trade with the Black Sea and the Mediterranean came to a halt. And as a result, the Jews were given all of the trade in the country. The nobility had exempted themselves from all royal courts, as well as military duty. There was a humanist movement that developed in Poland under Kazimierz, and it was under this humanist movement that, believe it or not, that slavery developed. Now, the opening of the Baltic trade developed Jewish capitalism in Poland. And it was the opening of the Baltics when Ivan the Terrible essentially lost it for Russia that suddenly grain could be traded throughout the world. And as a result, you have the development of slavery because the Polish nobility needed a cheap labor force. Lvov in Ukraine became essentially a new trade center. And you had an enormous growth of exports, which really largely assisted and benefited urban Jews. And as a result of that, many Polish noble families grew in wealth. And the Polish oligarchy, given the opening of the Baltics, came into its own as a force to be reckoned with. And municipal reform did exist in Poland, but it was completely dominated by the Polish nobility as well as the Jews. Cities were deeply divided, but ultimately Jewish money won the day. But nobles dominated the cities. They paid no taxes, and as a result, they had a preponderant influence over city life. And there was no merchants, as I said before, could not own land. It was occasionally possible for merchants to own land within a city. They could not own land outside of the city. And really, the wars against Ukraine both concerned a desire to have a toehold on the Black Sea, but also concerned themselves with grabbing as much fertile Ukrainian land as possible. Those Polish nobles who brought Jews into Ukraine were really commanded by the nobility itself to build fortresses against the Turks The Turks also had their own Jewish population in Constantinople, which they used for money. So the Jews were able to work both Polish and the Turkish empires together, and they continually, the Jews on both sides of that divide, continued to cooperate. And so this Jewish noble alliance permitted the nobles, really after the very beginning of the 16th century, to take over all military forces and force the military to become strictly noble-based. By the time the Renaissance hits Poland, royal domains become very, very small. And what will happen is that the Polish nobility will create protectionist barriers against all foreign competition, but the one group that is exempt from these barriers are the Jews. The Jews can trade with the Jews of Constantinople and Russia without any particular difficulty. Any native industry or any native merchant class was destroyed once the Polish nobility opened up the Baltics, began to export Polish, Ukrainian, and Russian grain abroad, and of course put a large duty on anything that was coming into the country, again, with the exception of the Jews. And this was, I guess, the real reason when Ivan the Terrible, Ivan IV, wanted the Baltics for himself. This was really the idea that brought Poland and Lithuania together to create their famous or infamous union that created essentially one monarch or one ruling class, I should say, over the two states. And it's because of this mentality that the Protestant Reformation did very, very well in Poland. It was a noble Jewish papal coalition where the behavior of these people was justified by the constant buying and selling of papal dispensations, and then eventually led to the Counter-Reformation, where monarchs like Sigmund brought the Jesuits in. So you had noble Jesuit Jewish alliance, and the slow but sure development of Protestant nobilities, who then didn't need to worry about papal dispensations, led to a major noble rebellion against Zygmunt on the one hand, as well as major Cossack rebellions in the Orthodox part of the Polish Empire on the other hand. Okay, so given all of that, I know I'm trying to cram a whole lot of history into, you know, 50 minutes here, but I really want to talk about, you know, the fall of Poland, what happens during and after the age of Sobieski. Sobieski rules largely from 69 to 1696, and, you know, it's really the height of a Polish power, because Sobieski really is one of the few people in Polish history to make the monarchy a powerful institution, and he'll do this by defeating the Turks consistently, and specifically in 1673, where a huge Turkish army is wiped out by Sobieski and his troops. He'll then take the title of Jan Sobieski III. But there's a problem, is that given the noble constitution of that country, somebody like Sobieski, no matter how talented the man is, no matter how he's able to defend Europe from the Turks, the fact is that he's become powerful, he's become popular, people are willing to lend him money because they know they're going to get a return on that investment. As a result, he threatens the nobles. The nobles will refuse to forward him any money in 1675. 2 years after his major victory over the Turks, of course, he had also defeated the Ukrainian hetman Doroshenko, and so Sobieski really is able to usher a new world for the Polish Empire, having just been able to, you know, kind of crawl out of the hole it was in after the Khmelnytsky rebellion in 1648. But because the nobles refused to give any more money to Sobieski, even though he was very successful, the Turks were able to take over much of Ukraine in 1675, And when the Muslims take over a Christian area, the first thing they do is absolutely plunder it, destroy it, and commit genocide on the population. And only then will they suddenly become very tolerant of the native institutions. And in fact, the nobles will reduce the official army that they in fact control under Sobieski's immediate command to 12,000 people, fearful that Sobieski will take away the rights and privileges of the nobility. So Jan Sobieski will eventually go to France for assistance, and then, but because of the work of Pope Innocent the 11th, the Austrian government will propose a better deal. So what happens is that the noble diet is split between those who support Vienna and those who support Paris, and the result, Turkish victories all over Europe in this particular period of time force an alliance. Forced an alliance of France, Austria, and Poland. And then when Poland goes to Russia, this Polish-Russian alliance is particularly frightening to the Turks. And actually it's going to be both the Pope of Rome and the Patriarch of Constantinople who will disrupt this alliance, because a Catholic power allying with an Orthodox power is absolutely out of the question. And the Turks will use their captive Patriarch of Constantinople, as well as the Catholics and the Pope of Rome, will be used to split this alliance up. Finally, the Turks will eventually be defeated in Hungary and in the Balkans. But the end of Sobieski's reign, roughly around 1696, will show substantial internal chaos. In Poland and Lithuania will be slowly drifting away from the Polish embrace. So by 1696, the Turks have been defeated. 1696, Poland is safe, but that's part of the problem. Polish nobles were willing to sell out the country. They were willing to sell out the country to the Turks if necessary, in order to maintain their privileges, and they take a man like Sobieski and cut him down to size, despite all of his victories, for the sake of maintaining their privileges, their close connection with the Jews. Sobieski realized that he could not go to the Jews for money, and so he goes both to France and Austria, creating even more chaos in the country, because what you end up having are noble families that are split between an alliance with France and an alliance with Austria, which in turn then forces the country to go to Russia, which as a result of that ends up creating more and more destruction, more and more division in the country. And eventually even the Pope himself will threaten to put the entire country under interdict unless the alliance with Russia is eliminated. The Patriarch of Constantinople, who of course is a citizen of Turkey and is controlled by the Turks at this time, also strongly threatens the Russian government with all kinds of excommunication and everything else if this alliance is not destroyed. So what do you have? We end up with is a Polish society that, due to noble arrogance, is completely, almost entirely annihilated. There is no substantial production except in parts of Ukraine. The Jews control the money, and the intellectual world is largely in the hands of the Jesuits. Outside of Sobieski, royal authority is almost non-existent, and when royal authority shows itself worthy of support, the nobles will do all they can to fight it and do harm to it. This really is the tragedy of Poland. The tragedy of Poland is that all of these causes, noble control, Jewish control over money, the manipulation of the church by secular powers, a constant battling between factions of the nobility relative to the alliance with France or Austria against the Turks, and including that faction of the nobility willing to go to Russia and yet another faction willing to go to the Turks. Anything to support their power. A greatly retarded industrial and agricultural system. You know, and once the Baltics are open early on in Polish history, there is money made, but not nearly as much as can be made. Polish nobles are willing to shut trade off entirely rather than see low-level nobles or high-level peasants engage in trade and create a thriving urban existence like you see in places like England and the Netherlands at the same time. And it's this distorted constitution that will eventually destroy Poland, will weaken her, create divisions upon divisions until at the last third of the 18th century, Poland will lose its statehood entirely in absolute devastation and poverty to Prussia, Russia, and Austria, all three of which are strongly centralized monarchies where the nobility to a large extent is kept in check. And that's the tragedy of Poland. That's the tragedy of Poland's domination of Ukraine and elsewhere, and ultimately where the Polish Empire will fall and why they fall. And it's an object lesson for any society and for any country. I know we've been all over the place in this talk. I've tried to cram a lot of history in here, but I want to provide you with the evidence to support the thesis that both noble and Jewish power are the main causal factors for the destruction of Poland and the destruction of the Polish Empire. I will talk to you next time. Hang in there. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Whoa!